everybody. Remember that a visualization of how one might imagine the fluctuations of a quantum field to look like. And we are still in this lecture three, we are still in the stage where we do a quick build-up to quantum field theory and how to calculate quantum fluctuations of fields. So remember that in quantum field theory, in second quantization, the degrees of freedom are not positions and momenta. The degrees of freedom that we are considering are the amplitudes of fields. And the number of degrees of freedom is therefore way larger than it used to be in first quantization, where for one particle we had like three positions and three momenta. So 3 degrees of freedom in total. But for a quantum field, we have at every point in space, we have a degree of freedom, the amplitude. And remember, we can see that in water by putting a cork in there, for example, it bobs up and down. And roughly in a harmonic way, if there was no other, there were no other waves around. If you just put it into a calm lake, then it will just bob up and down. But one of the observations that we will now go into more mathematically was that if you have multiple corks in there, they don't bob independently of another, but instead they're coupled. So while each one of them has a harmonic oscillator, obviously, these harmonic oscillators are coupled. So we should think of a quantum field, we should expect that mathematically a quantum field will be consisting of harmonic oscillators that are coupled. So that if you create waves over here, so you excite the harmonic oscillator that's sitting here, then it will, because it's coupled to the neighboring oscillators, it will lead to excitations of the neighboring oscillators, and they will excite their neighboring oscillators, and this is how a wave spreads. So in position space, we have at every location in space a harmonic oscillator, as you will see mathematically more precisely, and these harmonic oscillators are coupled. As we will also see later on today, in momentum space, it's different. In momentum space, we also have, at every point in momentum space, a harmonic oscillator. But they are not coupled to each other. If you excite a harmonic oscillator for one point in momentum space, then this is not going to excite the harmonic oscillators of other momenta. For example, take electromagnetic fields. Then consider one particular momentum, one particular wavelength. Let's say you create a laser wave of one particular wavelength. So you're exciting the harmonic oscillator of that particular wavelength. Well, is it going to excite oscillators of other wavelengths? No, generally not. You just excite one wavelength, so you make waves of light of one wavelength, it'll stay at that wavelength. We will make use of this fact by doing a Fourier transform from position space to momentum space. Position space, we had coupled harmonic oscillators, somewhat more difficult to handle. And in momentum space, we have uncoupled harmonic oscillators, easier to handle. And then we can transform back into position space if we prefer the picture there. And of course, in expanding curved space times, we will have to rethink this, but the general strategy will be the same. We will start with coupled harmonic oscillators, and we will look for transformations similar to momentum space transformations, or Fourier transformations, that will decouple these harmonic oscillators so that we can solve the theory by quantizing and solving the theory for the individual oscillators and then putting it all together. So remember the quantization conditions that we had. We have now at every point in space a degree of freedom, phi, and its canonically conjugate pi, and they don't commute for equal x. So if x is equal to x prime, those guys don't commute. They belong to the same degree of freedom. And so we have here that the Dirac delta peaks at x equal to x prime. However, the degrees of freedom located at different locations are independent degrees of freedom, and so the phi and the pi commute. Now all the degrees of freedom phi commute no matter where, and also the pi, the canonically conjugate ones, canonically conjugate observables commute. Just like in first quantization, all the x's commute with each other and all the p's commute with each other. Here in black, I sketched what these equations are analogous to in first quantization. So first quantization here, second quantization there. Now, so this made sure we are dealing with quantum theory, the quantization conditions. The equations of motion we keep the same. So we have that the canonically conjugate field is phi dot, as it would be in classical theory. And we have the Klein-Gordon equation. This is pi hat dot, the hat, of course, because it's an operator, the dot because it's a time derivative. Since pi is the time derivative of phi, this is really phi double dot. And therefore, this is just a regular Klein-Gordon equation. Second time derivative, second space derivatives, and then the mass. A third condition that we need to keep track of when we try to solve a quantum field theory is that if we start with a field that is real valued, like the Klein-Gordon field that we've been considering, so phi star is phi, then after quantization, once we put the hats on it, this becomes the condition that all the expectation and eigenvalues are real, which translates into the statement that the Hermitian conjugate of these operators at every point in x has to be the same as the operators themselves. So this is the full set of equations that we need to fulfill in order to solve our quantum field theory. Now, we had the proposition that the equations of motion, remember what they were, pi is phi dot and the Klein-Gordon equation. Those two equations of motion are indeed these two equations of motion, where the Klein-Gordon equation is something special. It's special for a scalar theory. It's different from the Maxwell equations. It's different from the Dirac equation. But all of those equations follow from the quantum theory, from the general abstract quantum theory, in which no matter what theory we are dealing with, whether this is the Maxwell equations or the Dirac equation or the Klein-Gordon equation or whichever else quantum field theory, the equations of motion should be these. The time derivative of an observable is the commutator of the observable with the Hamiltonian. Time derivative of that observable is the commutator of that observable with the Hamiltonian. It doesn't have to be phi or pi, it could be any observable in any quantum theory, first quantized or second quantized. And so we ended the previous lecture by discussing the Hamiltonian that does this. In second quantization, we can write down a Hamiltonian such that these two equations are actually the two equations of motion. Namely, that this is pi, right? Phi dot is pi, that was one of the equations of motion. So on the right-hand side, we had ih bar pi. And this was the Klein-Gordon equation. So the right-hand side had to have the Laplacian and m squared and all of those things. And it was a voluntary homework to check that this really comes out this way. And the Hamiltonian that does this is this one. I remember when I took a course in quantum field theory, we were not given the Hamiltonian. We were supposed to come up with it. We were told, there's got to be one that does this. Find it. Yes. And you have to fiddle with this and play around with it. Okay. So remember, we were following a plan here. We started with harmonic oscillators. Then we looked at relativistic fields. Then we discussed the general idea of second quantization. And now we want to look at harmonic oscillators in fields and how we would actually calculate vacuum fluctuations. We'll do that today with one method, and next time on Friday with a different method. So, harmonic oscillators in quantum fields. In which sense are quantum fields made out of harmonic oscillators? In which sense is this bobbing of the corks in the water, is that a harmonic oscillator, or is it because of, you know, a bunch of harmonic oscillators, one at every point in space, and they are being coupled? So let's look at this. Remember the equations that we need to solve. We need to solve the Klein-Gordon equation, and we need to solve the commutation relations. These are the key equations. The other ones are much easier to solve, like phi dagger is phi, like that pi is phi dot, and oh, yes, and that the phi phi commutator is zero, the pi pi commutator is zero. So here we have phi with pi, right? Pi is phi dot. So these are the equations that we need to solve. How can we solve them? The idea is to use the fact that they are quite similar to the equations of motion of harmonic oscillators, but they're not quite the equations of motion of harmonic oscillators. We will have to do some transformations and tricks in order to reformulate the problem that we need to solve in terms of clean, ordinary harmonic oscillators, which we can solve. And then we can undo the transformations that we did and get the solved quantum field theory. That's the overall strategy. Now, how can we do this? How can we transform the equations that we have to solve into literally the equations of harmonic oscillators? There are several difficulties. Let's start with the first one. So the first difficulty in reducing the problem of solving quantum field theory to harmonic oscillators is this. The Klein-Gordon equation here, our equation of motion, is analogous to the equation of motion of a bunch of harmonic oscillators, right? We have here pi dot of x. So we have for every label x, for every position, we have here the time derivative of a canonically conjugate momentum. And then we have something with a minus in front of it. And then we have that degree of freedom again. This is very similar to what we have in ordinary first quantized harmonic oscillators. Namely, we have that the canonically conjugate momentum dot is equal to minus something, and then it's the degree of freedom q. So it would seem that, yeah, what we have is a bunch of harmonic oscillators, right? But not quite, because as we discussed previously, this analogy would be right if there were no Laplacian here. Because if the Laplacian was absent, then we would have literally the time derivative equal to minus some positive number, and then the degree of freedom again. So for every value of x, we would have one of those equations there. We would have just a regular harmonic oscillator. It would be entirely that problem, except that in first quantization, we would have a countable number, or usually just a finite number of harmonic oscillators. In second quantization, we would have, well, for every x, for every location, we would have a harmonic oscillator. However, that's not how it is. And why not? Well, it's because if you throw a stone into a pond, the wave is going to propagate. You're not only going to have waves where the stone landed, but the harmonic oscillators are coupled to each other, so the wave spreads. And that is the job of the Laplacian. It couples different positions because it has the derivatives. If you discretized space, the Laplace operator would be a finite difference operator that couples the phi of one x to a phi at another x, and therefore these harmonic oscillators would be coupled. So this partial differential equation would then turn into a bunch of coupled ordinary differential equations. So this is preventing us from making the analogy straightforward. So this is not a number. If it were a number, preferably a positive number, well, then we'd be in business and we just have a number of harmonic oscillators to solve, but that's not what it is. So remember our strategy. We want to transform things, reformulate things such that they literally take the form of a bunch of ordinary harmonic oscillators, ordinary equation of motion, ordinary commutation relations. So let's do the first step towards that. Question is, can we transform this expression into something number valued? And the answer is yes, because remember that the Fourier transform turns derivatives into multiplications. Right? If you first Fourier transform a function and then multiply it with independent variable, or you first differentiate the function and then Fourier transform it, it's the same thing. Under the Fourier transform, derivatives become multiplications with independent variable, and under the Fourier transform, multiplications with independent variable become Fourier transforms, become derivatives. Okay, so let's do the strategy for this. Here's a picture, an intuitive picture. This is to symbolize quantum field theory in the position representation, where if you throw a stone in here, waves will propagate because the harmonic oscillator here and there and there and there, they're all coupled to each other through the Laplacian term. So they excite each other and therefore a wave spreads. But now let's look at the Fourier transform of all of this. Then how would that look like? I mean, this could be the surface of a lake in which you have waves roughly propagating in this way. You see, there's a little bit of a pattern here of the waves, something like this. And then maybe there's another wave that propagates like this or whatever, and then there's some other noisy waves around. What would be the Fourier transform of this? Well, the Fourier transform of a two-dimensional of a field in two dimensions is something in two-dimensional momentum space, and it might look like this. Now, when you look at the movie, you will see that here the waves propagate, but in the Fourier domain they wouldn't. Right? They would oscillate with their phases over time, but they wouldn't change, they wouldn't move out. Because if, for example, you have here a wave of wavelength 1 meter, it's going to stay a wave of wavelength 1 meter. It's not going to produce waves of wavelength 90 centimeters, 80 centimeters, or whatever. It's not. It stays at the frequency that it is. And so in the frequency domain, you can also identify a harmonic oscillator at every point in momentum space, as we will now see mathematically. And these harmonic oscillators will not be coupled. That's a huge advantage because then we can treat them separately. So let's do a Fourier transform of the spatial variables xi. Here's the definition of the three-dimensional Fourier transform as usual. So we take here the quantum field phi hat of x and t, multiply with the usual Fourier factor. In our units, h bar has numerical value 1, and therefore we drop the h bar from this, but in reality, of course, this is minus I x k over h bar. And there's an h bar in there as well. So the Fourier transform is this, as usual. And that would be the usual notation in math and in physics everywhere except in cosmology. In cosmology, we don't write phi hat of k and t, as it should be, because we are just Fourier transforming this x variable into that k variable. No, in cosmology, the traditional terminology is, or notation is, that we write this k here as an index. For some reason. I don't know why. So that shouldn't confuse you. It's just exactly the same as if you wrote phi hat of k and t. And if you hold the k fixed, then you get a function of t, and that function of t is called the k mode. So the mode k is, as we will see, a harmonic oscillator, and each one of these harmonic oscillators is called a mode, k mode. Zero mode would be where the k vector is zero, and that would correspond to something constant in space. Fourier transform is invertible, and the inverse transformation looks like this, of course, very similar, except that there's a plus sign where there used to be a minus sign, and now we adopt already the notation that the k is a subscript instead of being an argument. And on the right-hand side, we get back our phi hat of x and t. Now, the reason why multiplication and differentiation swap roles under Fourier transform is, of course, this. Imagine you differentiate this function here with respect to x. So let's say you multiply this with minus I d by dx. What do you get? If you do minus I d by dx on this, then we can, well, on the right-hand side, we get minus I d by dx on that. But the only x dependence in here is this, the Fourier factor. So the minus I d by dx brings down an ik. But we also have defined a minus I in here, so it just brings down a k. So what this means is that you do the same thing, whether you differentiate the Fourier transform with minus I d by dx, or you multiply phi hat of k with k. Same thing. So that's why multiplication turns into differentiation, and differentiation turns into multiplication. So let's see then what this does. I leave it to you as an exercise to prove this. Again, here is the first quantized analog with harmonic oscillators, and here is the quantum field theory that you're actually dealing with. So the proposition is that under this Fourier transform, our key expressions now take this form, the same Hamiltonian as before. So it's actually the same operator, right? Takes this form. And in order to verify that, you can simply take the phi hat of k, express it in terms of the Fourier transform, here too, express in terms of Fourier transform, this express in terms of the Fourier transform. So you get a bunch of integrals in here, and you get that all the k dependence goes away, and you get the fields are dependent on x, because you put the Fourier transforms in there. And then you work out all those integrals, you get Dirac deltas from all the exponential functions and stuff, and then you get back the Hamiltonian that you had before. Right? So this is the exact same Hamiltonian, just rewritten in different variables. The commutator, same thing. The commutator between phi and pi now takes this form. In order to prove it, just express this in terms of its, I mean, phi hat of k, we can write, phi hat of k is this, right? So we just substitute this expression for phi hat of k in here, the expression for pi hat of k in there, and then use the fact that we know what the commutator is between the phi hat of x and the pi hat of x, and then we can derive what the commutator of these guys is, and it's that. Where, notice, there's a plus sign here. Whereas we used to have x minus x prime, now we have a plus sign, we will have to deal with this a little later. Okay, so the commutators look like this. These are very familiar. This one has a plus sign over there. And how about the equations of motion? Well, we still have that phi dot is pi, that's good. And the Klein-Gordon equation now is of the form canonically conjugate momentum dot equal to minus something positive times the original degree of freedom. This is exactly how it should be for a harmonic oscillator. So that's beautiful. This is what we wanted, and this is what we got. The fact that the k can take any variables, can take any value, some 3 vector, and then we take the square of it, that's some scalar number, is fine. Remember, what we have here is that the k is basically a label. For every choice of k, we get one of those harmonic oscillators, which is a function of time, right? So you pick your k, so you pick a point in momentum space, and then you have an ordinary harmonic oscillator sitting there. The frequency of the harmonic oscillator depends on where you are in momentum space. The frequency is highest for the highest k and smallest for the smallest k. So it appears that we have, at every point in momentum space, a harmonic oscillator, and the frequency is the square root of this. Right? So we expect the frequency to be omega k equal to the square root of k squared plus m squared. Okay, so we have decoupled the coupled harmonic oscillators, as we anticipated from the intuition with the water waves, by going from position space to momentum space. Are we done? Have we solved all the problems? Not really. Now, I leave it to you as an exercise to show that the general equation of motion of any quantum theory, first quantized, second quantized, millions time quantized, you should always have that for any observable, the time derivative is given by minus I and then the commutator of the observable with the Hamiltonian. And just try it. Try to derive that the equations of motion that we just showed really still follow from the Hamiltonian that we just showed, even if you do all of this in momentum space. You can prove that directly in momentum space. You don't have to go back to position space to prove this. And it's easy in momentum space too, because you don't have the Laplacian to deal with. Okay, so our mission is to reduce the problem of solving a quantum field theory to the problem of solving a bunch of harmonic oscillators. The second difficulty that we need to address here is that the commutation relations have here a Dirac delta rather than a Kronecker delta. This means that unlike in the first quantized harmonic oscillators, where we have that if we choose the A and A prime to be the same, then we have Q and Q hat, P hat equal to I H bar. Now it looks like we have phi hat, pi hat at the same point in momentum space, k equal k prime, or actually we would have to take them k equal minus k prime. We have that this thing is peaking, not at one, but at infinity, or strictly speaking, not defined. So that doesn't look good. We want to reduce things to literally regular harmonic oscillators. So we'll have to do something about this Dirac delta and somehow try to turn it into a Kronecker delta, as it should be. At least it should be if what we want to do is reduce everything to techniques that we already have. So here the idea is to use the fact that when you do a Fourier transform, in principle you have to do an integral. But in certain circumstances, you get away with a series. And then instead of a Dirac delta, you get a Kronecker delta. Do you remember what the circumstance is in which the Fourier transform simplifies to a Fourier series? It's when you only have a finite interval. So what we can do is, we can pay a tiny little price, which is to say, we are not going to describe the entire universe, which might be infinite in size. We just describe a box in it. Now, that box may be a meter across, but it may also be a gazillion light years across. The main point here is that it is a finite size box. And we don't mean to describe the actual physics of the boundaries. If it's billions of light years away, it cannot affect the physics of here, but it helps us mathematically. So the strategy is to model the physics here in such a way that we put the system, the quantum system that we consider, the quantum field theory, into a large box, which is spanning from minus L half to L half in every direction, where L is a large distance. And then we assume some boundary condition on that box. We have to say what happens at the box in order to make the physics well defined. And one possibility is to assume periodic boundary conditions. We will later also see that we could, might implement Dirichlet boundary conditions. Each have their own advantages mathematically. Physically, they make no difference because that boundary is so far away that it cannot possibly affect what happens here. So for now, let's assume periodic boundary conditions. Then, instead of the Fourier transform, we can use the Fourier series. This trick is called infrared regularization, and it's very, very commonly used in quantum field theory. Why is it called regularization? Well, because it turns something ill-defined or infinite into something regular. Namely, as we will see in a moment, the Dirac delta turns into a Kronecker delta, which is just number valued. And infrared, well, that's a historical artifact. Infrared is nowadays, the term infrared nowadays is used in quantum field theory to indicate long wavelengths. You see, infrared is, literally speaking, the part of the optical spectrum that is having wavelengths that are too large for us to see. Just like ultraviolet is this part of the electromagnetic spectrum whose wavelengths are too short for us to see. So infrared simply stands for excessively long wavelengths. And that's the terminology we use it for in quantum field theory. So an infrared regularization means we don't allow arbitrarily large wavelengths. So we put the system into a box. All right, so what do we get from that? Infrared regularization. Well, if we put the system in a box and we assume periodic boundary conditions, it means that the plane waves of the Fourier transform, the e to the power I x k, can no longer have arbitrary values of k. Because only for particular values of k is this plane wave, e to the power I x k, periodic with the period L. And what are the allowed momentum values? Well, they are 2 pi over L times integers, positive or negative integers. It's the usual thing, particle in a box. It's the same mathematics. And periodic boundary conditions mean that not plane waves of all wavelengths can exist in a box with periodic boundary conditions. No, the plane waves have to have a particular discrete set of wavelengths such that they repeat themselves after L. The volume of the box is L to the third power, and we call it V. Then, this is just ordinary Fourier series, then we have that the Fourier transform, the Fourier series transform of our field phi hat, which now lives only in the box, from minus L half to L half in all three directions. The Fourier transform is then given by the original field multiplied with the usual Fourier factor. And then we need to integrate only over the box. The prefactor now changed, and it is simply 1 over the square root of the volume. And what we have on the left-hand side is the Fourier series transform of our field. And notice that the only thing that changed over before is this prefactor, and that we are not integrating over everything, but we are integrating only over the box. What stayed the same and is super crucial is this pattern here. Because what that means is that we are still turning a derivative, like for example, I times d by dk, into the multiplication with x and vice versa. So therefore, we can still expect that the Laplacian after this Fourier series transform turns into k vector squared. That's still the case. Super important, because that's why we do it in the first place, to decouple the harmonic oscillator, to get rid of the Laplacian, which has derivatives, into an expression in the Fourier transform space where we only have k vector squared that has no derivatives. Now, the inverse to this transformation no longer involves integrations. Remember, the Fourier series transform in one direction involves integrals, but in the other direction doesn't. Well, it cannot, because these guys only exist for a discrete set of k values, right? These k values here, these ones, right? Only these three vectors, which are 2 pi over L times these integers, this is an integer grid. So phi k is only defined for those values of k. So the inverse Fourier transform, inverse Fourier series transform works this way, that you can take these phi hat k, that live on this discrete momentum space. It's only a grid of points in momentum space. Those k are just a discrete set of three vectors. And then you sum them up with this Fourier factor, multiplied with 1 over square root of the volume, and you get back your original field. All right, so now the quantum field theory problem of solving the equations of motion and the canonical commutation relations reduces to this one. So after we've done the Fourier series transform, the Hamiltonian looks like this. And you see, this is now a much more friendly expression, because no more integral here, just a sum. Just like in first quantization when we have a bunch of harmonic oscillators. And the canonical commutation relations now have, as we wanted, a Kronecker delta here. The two arguments are k and minus k prime. And the k take values only in these discrete points in momentum space. Those guys always commute as usual, but remember that we now have harmonic oscillators not at every point in momentum space, but only on this discrete set, on this discrete set of points in momentum space. How about the equations of motion? Well, we still have that phi dot is pi, and we still have the Klein-Gordon equation with the k squared here. Because just like for the ordinary Fourier transform, the Fourier series transform also turns multiplications into differentiations and vice versa. All right, are we done at this point? Not really. There is something more that we need to worry about. There's the third difficulty in reducing the quantum field theoretical problem to harmonic oscillators. And that is hermeticity. Remember, we started with a field phi that was real number valued. The argument was that we get away with this, because in cosmology that's all we need. And if we absolutely wanted a complex value field, for example, to describe some charged pion or something, then because the Klein-Gordon equation doesn't mix the real and imaginary part, we can just solve it for the real and imaginary part separately and add them up. Okay, so we start with a real valued Klein-Gordon field, and then after quantization, it becomes a self-adjoint operator valued quantum field. So we have phi hat dagger equal to phi hat. And the same for the canonical conjugate momentum. But after our Fourier series transform, it looks different. Because these phi hat of k are not Hermitian anymore. They are no longer self-adjoint anymore. By the way, I'm using the terms self-adjoint and Hermitian interchangeably, even though technically there's a bit of a difference between the two. In physics, we usually don't distinguish, even though I have written like 2 dozen papers on the difference between the two. There is an important difference between the two, and we may get to that later on. But for our purposes at the moment, we are not precise enough in the discussion to distinguish the two. Okay, so the phi hat dagger is not phi hat. It is phi hat of minus k. And this minus sign here is messing things up a bit. Because for ordinary harmonic oscillators, we have that q hat is q hat dagger. And p hat is p hat dagger. But here, no, it's not true. The dagger of phi k is phi of minus k. And here's a proof of this, in case you want to see yourself how that happens. So that means that this equation and that equation don't match. And this is not quite of the same form as that. So we still haven't reduced the problem to ordinary harmonic oscillators. Our phi hat k and pi hat k are independent harmonic oscillators. So they're decoupled, the equations of motion for them are decoupled. And we have Kronecker deltas instead of Dirac deltas. But these guys are not self-adjoint values. So they wouldn't even count as observables in quantum theory. Because observables would have to be self-adjoint or Hermitian. So So what can we do about this? You see, we can't just overlook this problem because it runs deep. It is also the reason why the canonical commutation relations don't have Kronecker delta of k and k prime. They have Kronecker delta of k and minus k prime. That again is very different from first quantization, where we have that the q and the p have a commutator which is simply I h bar delta of a and a prime. So if and only if we're dealing with the same degree of freedom, then we have the I h bar, otherwise we have zero. And here it's weird because there's this minus sign. These guys don't commute if k prime is minus k instead of being k. Now, in the textbook of Mukhanov and Vinitsky that I was recommending to you, this one, which to some extent we are following, and we have the PDF of it on the website, Mukhanov is just not caring about it. I wouldn't recommend that, because this stuff is actually deep, and let's do it carefully, therefore. So here's a way to do this properly. To this end, let's define new variables, q hat k and p hat k, which are observables of ordinary, absolutely ordinary harmonic oscillators, quantum harmonic oscillators. And then our aim is going to be to express the actual quantum field theory completely, without approximations or anything, in terms of these ordinary harmonic oscillators. Because if we can do this, well then we can solve that problem and then we can re-express the quantum field theory in terms of that solution, so we have solved everything. So how can we do this? Okay, so we start with the observables of ordinary harmonic oscillators. And by that I mean that p hat should be q hat dot, and p hat dot is minus omega k squared qk, ordinary harmonic oscillators of frequency omega k. And we also assume the ordinary commutation relations with the k and the k prime. And we assume hermeticity, q hat dagger is q hat and p hat dagger is p. We can solve that problem. It's just a bunch of harmonic oscillators. For every k vector that we may choose to be on this discrete set of points in momentum space, we have a harmonic oscillator. And we can solve all of those. We can do it. What's missing is the link between the actual quantum field theory and these guys. How can we express the actual quantum field theory in terms of those regular harmonic oscillators? Here is how it works. It turns out it's not unique. And it's not unique for an interesting reason. But for now, let me just show you what it is. We can express our phi hat k in terms of these ordinary harmonic oscillators, one sitting at every one of these discrete set of points in momentum space. We can express our phi hat of k in terms of these guys in this way. So what do we have here? We have 1/2 of q hat k plus q hat minus k plus some prefactor which has an I here, and then p hat k minus p hat minus k. Let's let that sink in for a little bit. What do we have here? Here we have a self-adjoint operator, right? It's the sum of two self-adjoint operators. And here we have a self-adjoint operator, it's the difference between two self-adjoint operators. This accounts for the self-adjoint part of this operator, and that accounts for the anti-self-adjoint part, because you know this is just the self-adjoint operator right there. That's the self-adjoint operator multiplied with I. So the whole thing is an operator which is neither self-adjoint nor anti-self-adjoint. It's a sum of two. And of course, we know that. This guy is not self-adjoint. Can we diagonal? If this is true, I mean, we still have to convince ourselves that this is true. But if this is true, we have to ask, can we diagonalize this guy?
Let's look at it. It looks weird because the Q hat K does not commute with the P hat K. And this guy doesn't commute with that guy, right? Because here. So we know we can't diagonalize this one simultaneously with that one, or this one simultaneously with that one. Cannot do. So can we diagonalize this thing? It turns out we can. Because, see, this thing as an operator on its own is commuting with this operator as on its own. You can think of it this way. This is like the center of mass of two particles. And this is like the relative momentum between two particles. And those degrees of freedom are different. See, for example, for the hydrogen atom, you have the proton, you have the electron. You can look at the center of mass degree of freedom and the relative distance degree of freedom. And the center of mass degree of freedom also has a canonically conjugate, which is the total momentum of the hydrogen atom. And then the relative distance degree of freedom, which would be the Qk minus K, that degree of freedom also has the canonically conjugate momentum, and that would be obtained from the difference between the two momenta. That would be that one. So these are, this one is taken from the center of mass degree of freedom. This one is taken from the relative momentum degree of freedom. These guys commute with each other. We can also see it this way. Those two don't commute. They produce an IH bar. These guys also don't commute and produce an IH bar, but with a minus sign in front. So therefore, this commutes with that. So we have the sum of two commuting self-adjoint operators, and so the whole thing actually is diagonalizable. By the way, you may know, well, you should know, that the spectral theorem tells us that if an operator is self-adjoint, you can diagonalize it. It also tells us that if an operator is unitary, you can also diagonalize it. Are these the only two kinds of operators that can be diagonalized? No. There's a whole class of operators that can be diagonalized. Remember that if an operator is self-adjoint, then it means that you have that Q dagger is Q. Okay, these guys you can diagonalize. If an operator is unitary, you have that U dagger is U minus 1. These guys can also be diagonalized. But the spectral theorem says more generally that if you have an operator, let's call it N, and if this operator commutes with its Hermitian conjugate, well, then it's diagonalizable. Diagonalizable. Okay? Now, for self-adjoint operators, that's obvious, right? Because it's simply the commutator between Q and Q. Obviously, a self-adjoint operator commutes with its adjoint because it is its adjoint. How about for unitary operators? Well, that means now we have to check whether an operator commutes with its inverse. Yeah, clearly it commutes with its inverse. So therefore, that's true too. But there are more operators that can be diagonalized that may not be self-adjoint or unitary. If only they commute with their adjoint, then they're so-called normal operators. And those guys are diagonalizable, and that's one of those that we have here. It has both a self-adjoint component and an anti-self-adjoint component, which is a self-adjoint component with an I in front of it. And what makes it normal is that this one is commuting with that one, so that we can diagonalize both in the same basis, right? Because they commute, we can diagonalize them both in the same basis. And then in that basis, the eigenvalues are going to have a real part from here and an imaginary part from there. That's how this happens here with the phi hat of K. Okay. Now, I'm doing this all the tedious way here because once in one's life one needs to see how this works. In practice, it will be more convenient, and we will, after this, then later in the course, choose the more convenient path, where we will say, okay, we can express the phi hat in terms of these clean Q and P's of ordinary clean harmonic oscillators. But remember that harmonic oscillators can also be expressed in terms of A and A dagger operators. And it turns out that quantum fields are most conveniently expressed directly in terms of the A and A daggers. So instead of writing the field phi in terms of the Q and the P in this way, with four terms in there, we can also express the quantum field in terms of the A and A daggers that come with these guys. And then the quantum field phi hat k is simply prefactor times a plus a dagger. A k and a dagger minus k. But in order to see that we really are dealing with ordinary harmonic oscillators, it's worth once at least to explicitly write it out in terms of ordinary harmonic oscillators. So later on we will see that we can express the field conveniently in terms of these A and A dagger operators, where the A and A dagger operators are obtained as usual as linear combinations of the X and the P with suitable prefactors. All right, so now, and I leave it to you as an exercise to work out the details of this, we can prove that our ansatz succeeds, which means that this succeeds. This was an assumption here, an ansatz, that we can write the field in terms of these guys, where these are ordinary harmonic oscillators and this is the actual field. So what we need to show is that this works, and what we then find is that the Hamiltonian of the quantum field, when expressed in terms of these Qs and Ps, actually becomes this, which is the sum of ordinary harmonic oscillators. One ordinary harmonic oscillator for every point in momentum space. It's literally just the sum of ordinary harmonic oscillators. And the equations of motion are fulfilled, the canonical commutation relations come out right, even with the minus sign over here. Everything is as it should be, with this minus sign over there, this guy is not Hermitian, etc., etc. But we have expressed everything in terms of ordinary harmonic oscillators. Well, and then, remember that this is not where we started the phi k. Where we started was phi hat of x. And then before we transformed it to get rid of the Laplace of the Laplace operator, right? So we can undo this, we can go back from the Fourier domain to the position domain, and we can now express the field phi hat itself in terms of those harmonic oscillator degrees of freedom, one for every point in momentum space. And that's how that looks like then. So the field itself is then prefactor times cosine in a spatial cosine, a spatial sine, and then those harmonic oscillator degrees of freedom. Now, there is a caveat in all this, which is that what we did was not unique. So we did succeed in expressing our quantum field in terms of ordinary harmonic oscillators in this way. But that was not the only way we could have done it. We could have mixed the Qs and the Ps differently. We could have, for example, here used only Ps and there only Qs. Or we could even have used Qs and Ps here with suitable prefactors and Qs and Ps over there with suitable prefactors. And if, you know, we just make a general ansatz in this, we will see there's infinitely many ways to do this. This, though, will be the way that is the correct way for Minkowski space. For general curved spacetimes, it will be difficult to find out which is the proper decomposition. However, well, a significant portion, in fact, of later of a stretch in this course later on will be about exactly that question. How do we solve the quantum field theory by expressing it in terms of ordinary harmonic oscillators, which we can then solve? Because that question is the question of which state in the quantum field theory describes the vacuum state on which we built the rest of the theory. on which we build and identify what multiparticle states are, what thermal states are, and so on. So it's a super important question. But technically, we will not do it exactly the same way as we did it today. But instead, we will do it this way. Remember, I said that we can express the phi hat in terms of the Q's and the P's. But it turns out that this is basically just the A operator, and that's basically just the A dagger operator. And that's much more convenient to simply write that our phi hat K is up to a prefactor A plus A dagger. So therefore, what we will later do in this course is we will struggle with the question, how do we express phi hat of K as a combination of A and A dagger operators? And we will find, oh, there are infinitely many ways to do this. Which is the right way? And then we will study the math and the physics behind it to identify which is the right way to do it. The right way to do it will be, in order to find out what the right way is, we will have to find out how to identify which state in the quantum theory is the vacuum state. Okay, but for now, it's all relatively straightforward. I just wanted to make you anticipate what comes up later in this course. So what is the significance of the non-uniqueness? I already said it. The ground state of these Q and P oscillators will be what we call the vacuum state. But that, it turns out, need not be the lowest energy state of the quantum field theoretical Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonians of these harmonic oscillators that we use, these auxiliary harmonic oscillators, are auxiliary. What really matters is the Hamiltonian of the quantum field theory. So the problem of representing the quantum field in terms of ordinary harmonic oscillators is the problem of identifying which state in the theory is the vacuum state. Okay, for now, we solved our quantum field theory using that ansatz, which, trust me on that, is the right ansatz for Minkowski space. We identify the vacuum state correctly there. So what we solved is the equations of motion, namely that phi dot is pi, the Klein-Gordon equation, the hermeticity conditions, and the canonical commutation relations. All of this came out, as it should be. And now, we should be ready to calculate anything we want in our quantum field theory, because we've solved it, right? Because we've expressed the quantum field in terms of ordinary harmonic oscillators, and I'm now just simply assuming you know everything about quantum harmonic oscillators. So you know everything about the quantum field theory now. Because we can calculate anything we want for these ordinary harmonic oscillators, and they are the building blocks for the quantum field theory. So what do we need to do in order to do that? Well, we solve the system of infinitely many quantum harmonic oscillator degrees of freedom of the ordinary kind. Right? So we remember that for every point in momentum space, this discrete grid of momentum space, we have a degree of freedom Q hat, a degree of freedom P hat, and they have the usual commutation relations, and the total Hamiltonian is given by the sum of the Hamiltonians of the individual harmonic oscillators. And these harmonic oscillators have frequencies omega k, where omega k was square root of k squared plus m squared. Remember, this came from the Fourier transform of the term Laplace minus Laplace plus m squared. And the k values are discrete. They take these values, the k vectors take these values, where the n's are positive, arbitrary positive and negative integers. All right, so we have all of those many ordinary quantum harmonic oscillators. And so we have a huge quantum system, which doesn't have just the usual, like, 3 degrees of freedom for a three-dimensional harmonic oscillator. No, now we have infinitely many one-dimensional harmonic oscillators of this kind. Infinitely many because there are infinitely many of these k values. So the Hilbert space is now the tensor product of the Hilbert spaces of these individual harmonic oscillators. And in that total Hilbert space, we can now choose a state. Now, what would be a state we could choose, for example? What would be the simplest? Well, we could choose the state which is the tensor product of the ground states of each one of these infinitely many harmonic oscillators. Now, each one of these harmonic oscillators has its ground state. And the tensor product of all these ground states is the ground state of the total Hamiltonian. Why do we know that? Well, we know that because there is no interaction between these harmonic oscillators. So the total lowest energy state is simply the state which is the tensor product of the lowest energy states of all of its constituents, all of its constituent harmonic oscillators. So it's all very simple in this case. And we could choose, for example, for the state psi in that total system of infinitely many harmonic oscillators, which is really the system of the quantum field, we could choose some arbitrary vector psi, which we may choose to be the tensor product of all the ground states of the harmonic oscillators, or, for example, the state which is the tensor product of all the ground states of all the harmonic oscillators, but for one of these harmonic oscillators, located at our favorite point in momentum space, let's say that harmonic oscillator we choose to be in the seventh excited state. That's the state of the quantum field theory. All the harmonic oscillators in the ground state except for one of them. So the total state is a tensor product of ground state, ground state, ground state, ground state, etc. And then we come to this harmonic oscillator of momentum k, our favorite momentum k, seventh excited state, then the ground state, ground state. And we can also look at linear combinations of guys like this. So in this way, we can write down arbitrary states of our quantum field theory. Now, the particular state psi obtained by taking the tensor product of the ground states of all the harmonic oscillators, for now, will be called the vacuum state. It's the lowest energy state of the quantum field. And it's the lowest energy state of all the individual harmonic oscillators. We call this the vacuum state. Later we will see that in quantum field theory and curved space-times in general, we don't get away with this, as we already discussed. But for now, in Minkowski space, that's how we can do it. In Minkowski space, the state without particles is the lowest energy state. In general, it's not. Now, once we've chosen the state of this huge system of all the harmonic oscillators, once we've chosen the state psi, we can calculate whatever we want for this system of infinitely many harmonic oscillators and therefore of the quantum field theory. In particular, we can find the probability distribution for particular values of qk, the probability distribution of particular value of pk. Or, what we really need, the probability distribution for the observable qk plus q minus k. And the probability distribution of the observable I times pk minus p minus k. Because these are the two observables that go into phi k. In any case, we can calculate all of those probability distributions. And, for example, if we work with the vacuum state, the lowest energy state, then we know that this is Gaussian distributed, that is Gaussian distributed, and everything we calculate as linear combinations of these guys will be just linear combinations of Gaussians. So what we find is a probability distribution, for example, for the QK, which is just given like this. It's up to normalization factor e to the power of minus, and it turns out to be omega k QK squared. In the next lecture, we will by some other method, come to the same conclusion, and you will calculate exactly why the probability distribution is Gaussian with this particular prefactor and so on. Exponent up here. So once we've chosen the state of the quantum field, psi touches the vacuum state. We can calculate all the probability distributions for the Qs and the Ps. And we can calculate the probability distribution, therefore, for the phi Ks. Right? For phi K. The probability distribution for an individual harmonic oscillator is this. But we can also calculate the probability distribution for the observables that make up the phi subscript K. Okay, so we can, given psi, the state of the field, it's like vacuum everywhere for all momentum, for all momenta, all the harmonic oscillators are in the vacuum state, except for one that might be in the seventh excited state, for example, we can calculate the probability distribution for phi hat k and pi hat k. More accurately, we can calculate the probability distribution for the real part of it, which is an observable, and the imaginary part, which is an observable. Since the two commute, we can measure them both simultaneously. So in principle, we could think of a measurement apparatus that would measure the imaginary part and the real part of phi k. And if we are so inclined, we could also measure this, but not both. But we can measure one of them. We can measure, for example, all of the phi hat k's. Now if we do this, what would we find? We will find, as we will see with other methods next time, given the vacuum state, since the QK and the PK are Gaussian distributed, it turns out also the phi K and the pi K are Gaussian distributed. So in particular, if we wanted to measure the phi hat K observable, the real part and the imaginary part of it, then what we would find for the probability distribution of a particular coefficient, phi k, which will have a real part and an imaginary part to it, and that probability distribution is given by, up to normalization, e to the power of minus omega k, and then just the modulus squared of the number we are looking for. Okay, so this is a probability distribution, just like we had up here. If we have an ordinary one single quantum harmonic oscillator, then it's sort of oscillating here in the Q direction, left and right. If it was a classical harmonic oscillator, it would just go like this. Okay? For a quantum harmonic oscillator in a ground state, this is the probability distribution for finding the harmonic oscillator at this Q value, or that Q value, or that position, or that position, and so on. It's just Q values, right? And if we prepare our quantum harmonic oscillator many times in the ground state, and once we've prepared it, we measure it, we find some value for Q. If we prepare it again, measure it, we find some other value for Q. And this is just a probability distribution for how these measurement outcomes are distributed. So now we can do something very similar in principle. We prepare our quantum field in the vacuum state, for example, and then we go and measure all the phi k. Hypothetically, if we had a suitable measurement instrument, we measure all the phi k. And for every phi k, we find a complex number. And then we prepare the quantum field again in the vacuum state, because remember, measuring disturbs the state. So now we prepare the quantum field again in the vacuum state. We measure again all the phi k simultaneously. Remember, they commute. The phi k hat commute. We can measure them all at the same time. And every time we get a bunch of complex numbers. And we can keep doing this. This is the probability distribution for these complex numbers. For example, the phi k, remember, these are complex numbers. These are Fourier coefficients, right, of the phi x, phi of x. We can ask, what are the chances that we find a really large Fourier coefficient? Well, let's see. Let's just plug it in there. So we plug in here, let's say, 1,000 plus I times 2,000. That's a large Fourier coefficient. Are we going to find that very often? Let's plug it in here. Then we have here 1,000 plus I times 2,000. And here we have 1,000 minus I times 2,000. Right? So this, in total here, is like a million. So this is e to the power minus omega k times a million. That is small. Right? So we are very unlikely to to measure phi k, which is a large coefficient. Small coefficients are going to be likely, but not large coefficients. And that is why we don't see much vacuum fluctuations of a field. Because in order to have large amplitudes in position space, we also need large amplitudes in Fourier space. But you see here that they are Gaussian, this Gaussian suppressed. Large Fourier coefficients are unlikely to be found. But what we can do, and this is what's going to be the project in this course, we can do is we can take this probability distribution, and remember that the omega k depends on k, on the momentum, and we can draw from it. We can simulate that process of preparing the field in the vacuum state, and then measuring all the phi k, getting a bunch of complex numbers according to this probability distribution. And so we get all these complex numbers there, and then we can do the Fourier transform in order to obtain the phi of x. Because whether we measure in momentum space or position space, the same thing at the end of the day. We're just measuring the amplitudes. So once we draw from that probability distribution one phi k for every k, one complex number for every k, we can then go into the inverse Fourier series transformation and calculate how the field that we just drew looks like. And that's how it looks like. So we choose the vacuum state, psi naught, and then we draw a field phi of x at random out of its probability distribution. How? Well, we don't draw phi of x directly. We draw the phi k coefficients, the phi k, the Fourier coefficients, we draw them according to their probability distribution that we just calculated. And once we have all those numbers phi k, we can go into the inverse Fourier transform and plot what phi of x looks like. So what we see is a typical distribution of the quantum fluctuations of a field if the field is in a vacuum state. Now, what you can do, of course, is play with this. You can say, what if one of those harmonic oscillators of the field is not in the ground state, but let's say in the seventh excited state? That means that the distribution here, as we will see in more detail next time, that the distribution, the probability distribution for that harmonic oscillator is no longer Gaussian. It's going to be the probability distribution of a harmonic oscillator in its seventh excited state, which is the seventh Hermite function times the Gaussian. And that seventh Hermite function doesn't look like a Gaussian anymore. It's quite suppressed for low amplitudes, and then it has these bulges out there further out, which means we are now somewhat more likely to find larger amplitudes, to find larger Fourier coefficients. If, for example, this one harmonic oscillator was in its millionth eigenstate, well, then the probability distribution is very much shifted out to large values. And therefore, if you draw from that probability distribution for that harmonic oscillator, you're likely to find pretty large coefficients, pretty large Fourier coefficients. And what does that mean if you plot the curve then? If you plot the field, if you do the inverse Fourier series transform? Well, then you get Fourier coefficients that are all very small, except for one, right? Because all the Fourier coefficients are drawn from harmonic oscillators in the ground state, where large amplitudes are suppressed in a Gaussian fashion. But for this one harmonic oscillator that in its millionth excited state, you're quite likely to find a relatively large Fourier coefficient. And then when you do the Fourier series transform from the Fourier series coefficients to the phi of x, that one term will multiply a plane wave, right? The plane wave of its k. And so what we should expect is a curve like this, except there should be clearly visible a wave going in this way, right? Namely, the wave that is of that k vector where the harmonic oscillator is excited. So what we see is that the excitation of a harmonic oscillator of wave vector k means in position space that we have a particular, let's say if it's the wave vector that goes in this direction, and we would have a plane wave should be visible there most of the time when we draw from the probability distribution. And as we will later see, when one of those harmonic oscillators is excited to the nth level, this will correspond to n particles being present who have the momentum k. So what we will see is that the existence of particles of momentum k translates into, corresponds to, means an enhanced probability for finding in the field waves of the plane waves of that particular momentum k. And in general, if there's a superposition of having lots of particles around, then on top of the vacuum fluctuations that we see here, we can see, you know, multiple waves going this and that way and so on, depending on how many particles there are. So part of the project is going to be to play with this and do this in two dimensions, three dimensions, with mass, without mass, with particles, without particles, one particle, a million particles, and so on, play with that before we even get into curved space. Okay, and today I just gave you one method, but tomorrow we'll discuss another method for these things, and that's it for today. So see you on Friday. Okay, any questions? Yes?
So in that diagram,
yeah.
So that's the...
It's the contour lines.
Okay, in a space.
Yes, well, in space. So it's a snapshot in time.
Okay, yeah.
Snapshot in time, and then in space, the phi hat of x, of x1 and x2, these are lines of equal amplitude phi hat, or phi. Once we measure it, it's just a real number, right? So phi hat is a self-adjoint operator. You measure it, you get a real number. And we get it through the Fourier transform of the phi hat k, phi hat of k.
So I see the yellow lines, red lines, and orange. So is it like if I look in a 3D, then there should be like, you know, mountains.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So this is a two-dimensional case, and the amplitude is kind of plotted outwards. I could have, I mean, this was just a contour plot, but I could also have chosen a 3D plot where this would be kind of a landscape. Over a two-dimensional plane. And of course, in the project, you're free to choose whatever you like. I mean, play with it and see what works best. Okay. See you Friday.